Happy Christmas! Welcome to the Physics Teaching Podcast, a podcast for teachers of physics, made by physics teachers.
Ho ho ho.
Ho ho ho, bar humbug. I'm much more of a bar humbug person, I have to say.
Turkey sandwich?
Turkey curry.
Lovely. What we have to look forward to, eh?
So, you're listening to me, Thomas WP. I'm a part-time A-level, mostly a little bit of Year 7 physics teacher. And I'm joined by Robin Griffiths.
Yes, and I'm a full-time teacher of physics from Year 8 through to Year 13.
And I'm still basking in the warm glow of having done a podcast on bikes.
Yes, wasn't that great?
It was great. And we had a really nice comment on Instagram at physics_teaching_podcast.
Of course.
Where we now have, Robin, 120 followers.
That's almost 1,000.
Yeah, your mass is so good. So thank you, Andy C. Pugh, who said, a great episode, thank you. I can still remember my head of physics face when he came into my lab many, many years ago, the morning after I had hung a mountain bike on the wall as a teaching point. So much physics in it. Another is the difference between holding a bike by the frame or the foam handlebar grips when it's been kept in a cold shed.
Oh, yes. Clever, of course, yeah.
No, we didn't mention that, did we?
No, we didn't. We didn't have that idea of conduction being part of it as well. Yes, of course you could do that as well, couldn't you? Yes, yes.
It reminded me of one of my nice little demos, which is you produce a saucepan and a wooden chopping board, and you say, right, I've got two pieces of ice here in this ice tray. I'm going to put one on the warm chopping board. They all know it's warm. And I'm going to put one on the cold, in the cold saucepan, and they all know it's cold. And which one's going to melt first?
Aha. Uh-huh.
I love those counterintuitive ones.
Yes, absolutely. They all think it's going to be the... And it's the metal carrying the heat away, of course, that it takes the heat away from the point, which is why it feels cold, because it's transporting the heat away from your hand very quickly.
Yes. It's a beautiful, simple little demo. Anyhow, happy Christmas, Robin. Bar humbug.
Ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho. We thought, since it's just before Christmas, we would talk about our stealth physics fun lessons. You can see my fingers saying fun lessons.
Yes.
Not a big fan of fun lessons. How about you?
No, not at all, actually. I think this is you get so little time with the kids, really, to and there's so much physics to cover that the idea of a fun lesson is, not good. And, of course, what we're talking about here is just something that's a little bit different, aren't we, really? Something that's a little bit different.
It's more different lessons.
Yes, and that's the thing. And there's plenty of physics that you can do that is fun in that sense, in that it's something a little bit different, it's a context they haven't seen before, or maybe taking something they have learned before and stretching and challenging them with it.
So you go first. What have you got for a fun lesson?
The thing is, now that I'm a physics-only teacher, and but given that this is the physics teaching podcast and not the science teaching podcast, I have to say, with all due respect to our chemist friends, that all of my engaging lessons around Christmas time used to involve flame tests, things like that in chemistry, which I suppose at a stretch could be physics, but is more chemistry. So a physics one that I think would be quite fun is fairy lights. So get your circuit construction kits out. You're going to need as many bulbs as you can lay your hands off, and challenge the kids to make a string of fairy lights that is as bright as they can possibly make it. And there's a lot of physics in there because it's not quite as simple as it might first appear. Everybody's probably sitting there going, oh, yeah, you connect them all in parallel. Well, you do, and you collect them all in parallel. But then, of course, if you've got about 20 bulbs drawing off, let's say, two cells, well, the internal resistance of the cell is going to come into play, and you're going to find your bulbs start dying pretty quickly with that level of current.
So is the criteria that the lights have to be bright?
Yeah, as many bright lights as you can get.
And another physics-y thing you could do is multicoloured, couldn't you? You could have some gels there, multicoloured lights.
Yes, you could. You could do that, and you could talk about the ideas, and you could talk to your art department about this. I was talking to our head of arts at our school the other day, and we were saying we have to do a joint lesson on colour, because she did a lot of things on pigment versus light and all this sort of stuff, and the difference between the two, and how you had primary and secondary colours, and you had colours that were, how did she put it? Colours that were transmission and colours that were blocking or something like that. Anyway, so, but loads I thought we could do there together. So you could have a chat with your art department about that.
Yeah, but going back to your circuit, I can see the internal resistance of the cells would become a problem as the current ramped up for those bulbs in parallel.
Yeah, so what do you have to do to lower?
Yeah, I mean, it's an A-level-y sort of question, this. It's not just a little Year 7. If you wanted them to explain it, that would be more A-level. I'm guessing you'd put more cells in parallel.
You're guessing absolutely correctly. But the thing is, you don't have to explain internal resistance to the kids. You can just say in terms of, well, you know, you're drawing, they know that every time you add a branch to the circuit, you get an extra route for current and you get more current flowing in the main part of the circuit. So you can say, wow, with all that current flowing, the battery just can't keep up. So you can put it in those sorts of terms and say, how might you connect some more batteries to make sure that you still have 3 volts across your bulbs, but you have lots more batteries sharing the load? How might that work? You can't connect them in series, can you? Oh, no. So how might you collect them? You connect them in parallel, of course, and then the internal resistance becomes shared, so reduces.
Yeah, that's very Christmassy, Robin, and I have to say I'm such an old Scrooge. I just don't do seasonal things. I'm like you. I did the odd Christmas thing with the, what's that cardboard tree that you put, I think it's in borax solution or something, and you make it. I'm muddling up my chemistry now, and it makes a Christmas tree.
Oh, I can't remember. Yeah,
and
that's
then you
what I
nudge
mean.
It, and it all falls apart or something. I can't remember.
Yeah, most of mine. But to be honest, with the fairy lights one, you could challenge them to sort of get some green sugar paper, make a cone out of it, then put the lights through little holes in the thing, so you could build a proper Christmas tree to display their nice fairy lights. Yeah. But there's some physics in there as well. Or indeed, in your case, you could build a little model workhouse in which you had the lights burning brightly.
I could.
For all the destitute at Christmas time, you know.
I mean, I'm terrible. My fun lessons are things like quizzes, which are actually revision, but they're competitive, which I'm sure many, many teachers do routinely. I just don't, so they're special when I do them. But I like just hit touching on bad movie physics, and I think the kids are now getting a bit old for this, because I've used The Incredibles for ages for bad movie physics, but I suspect the latest batch of kids, the new generation, aren't that up to date with The Incredibles. Not the film they had when they were a kid, is it? But I shall tell you my favourite Incredibles bad movie physics.
Yeah,
and I start this by saying, what are Mr. Incredible's superpowers? So, Robin, have you seen the film?
I have seen the film. His superpowers are super strength. Basically, it's pretty much it, isn't it?
Super strength, and I think you could push out to invulnerable, because at one point that robot stabs him and it cuts his shirt, but he's not damaged. So I think he's invulnerable as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So you didn't notice the sticky feet?
Sticky feet.
Sticky feet, I think.
He's got sticky feet, has he?
He's either got sticky feet or he's got mass, centre of mass adjustment powers that's not so obvious. Because there's a really good scene where, right at the start, when he's helping get a cat out of a tree, and he picks up this huge tree by the end and starts shaking it to get the cat out. And then he picks it up and whams it in front of the car with the baddies in. And I take it as a stability moments question. So I get Lego, I get the kids with Lego to make a tree. And make a Mr. Incredible holding the tree. And then get them to stand it up. And, of course, they can't. Because the centre of mass is firmly outside the base. Obviously, this takes some time. But, I love that. It looks so obvious that it works, but it can't work. And if you actually do the moments calculation, so I'd be doing this with 16-year-olds and with sixth form. If you do the moments calculation, the moments are insane. It's a good Fermi problem of estimating all the forces involved. So, you know, if his hands are 2 meters apart and he's the tree is the same density as water and it's 100 meters long and a meter diameter, etc., 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 you can get to the tree is about 100 tons and you work out the pressure under his hand pushing down to lift the tree up before you can get to the fact he's got sticky feet. The pressure would just be pushing straight through the wood and out the other side.
So this is why I'm so sad that we're not teaching in the same school anymore, that I don't get to see the parade of year sevens tearfully emerging from your classroom. Going, Mr. WP just proved Mr. Incredible doesn't exist. And there's you waving them a cheery goodbye. Merry Christmas,
Merry
children.
Merry Christmas, children. Well, I had year seven today. They seemed happy enough. We did an investigation.
Absolutely. What were you investigating today?
It was from the podcast. It was the dropping the fairy cake cases, the cupcake cases.
Excellent.
And I linked it back to Lizzie Banks, who's a very good female cyclist, and if you pedal harder, do you go even faster? I can't remember exactly how I put it, but the graph they all got when we shared the data, I did the graph on the board, they didn't do the graph. The graph we showed that if you double how hard you pedal, which is, you know, 2 cupcake cases, 4 cupcake cases, you don't go twice as fast.
Yes.
So, and it was really teaching them about doing an investigation and about, you know, about variables, very simple stuff. It was their first real investigation they've done. But it's brilliant. Those cupcake cases, I can't tell you how good they are to experiment with.
They're amazing.
Yeah, amazing, brilliant.
Well, no, it's almost like they're designed, isn't it, that to not flip. They never, never, never flip. Something about the design of the cases, those grooves down the outside, just basically, there's no way. They're absolutely aerodynamically stable. Aerodynamic stability, that's clearly what the cupcake manufacturers were going for, but nonetheless.
Exactly what they went for. No question.
Do you imagine in the cupcake case factory when they drop them? Because if you notice, they always land the same side up. How's that work? Another good thing I do at Christmas is the old how fast does Santa have to go? I mean, it's such a well-hackneyed and well-worn trope, but it is the thing of how fast does Santa have to go if he's going to finish visiting every child in the world? And, of course, you were saying about Fermi problems. This is a great way of introducing these ideas of estimation to younger kids, because they will engage with this one. I tend to find most younger kids, when you start talking about estimation, they just think you've lost your mind as a physics teacher. Surely physics teachers are just looking to turn the universe into this big clockwork machine where if you know it in enough detail, you can tell exactly what's going to happen for the rest of your life. And of course, that's not quite the point, and we have to estimate quite a lot. But this is one where you can really... So how many kids are there in the world? And, you know, how does Santa get around the world? And how is he going to get between all these houses? And what distance does he have to travel? And yeah, so you can go into this as deeply as you want and get the kids to estimate. And how many presents does he have to get? And, you know, eventually you can get to... And even if you want to talk to your A-level kids about it, you can talk about the relativistic effects for Santa, which it turns out that there are some, because that's a lot of massive presents he has to carry around.
Yes, I was going to get onto that. I think that is another one that feeds into A-level if you've got relativity involved. But I was just thinking that's a hell of a travelling salesman problem, isn't it? Santa's... Mm. Delivery schedule.
Oh yes, it's really hard. So I mean, you've got to come to some sort of estimation of that, because you're never going to be able to work out the optimal way for him to random walk his way around the world. But you've got to say, okay, well, it's not going to be a straight trip from North Pole, fly south, go all the way around the bottom and go back again. There's a lot more to it than that. He's got to cover pretty much every continent in the world and go backwards and forwards. So how many miles is that? How many kilometres is that?
I think it's rapidly turning into a maths lesson, isn't it? But I like the Fermi problem concept.
Yes. Well, there's a lot of maths in physics, I've noticed. Has anybody else noticed that? There's quite a bit of maths. I don't... Is it just me?
I was struggling with a... I'm going to be contacting you later. I was struggling with an Isaac physics problem. Is there an Isaac physics answer booklet? Because I wish I need it.
No, they never did one, did they? I think they didn't do an Isaac physics answer booklet, but for some reason.
I had a nice Twitter thread on that. You know, people putting GIFs of when you realise you can't answer a level 6 Isaac physics problem.
Yeah, I saw those.
So there must be something else. What do? I mean, I just am a proper curmudgeon. I just don't do... I always teach. I say to them, if you want a fun lesson, well, let's get through this work and then we'll do it for the last half hour. And I just do something really quick at the end.
So physics for Christmas decorations was fun. I mean, how many balloons to carry a kitten into space? How many helium balloons to get a kitten into space is what I used to do with my year 12s and 13s, which they used to love because everybody loves being cruel to a kitten. Yes, you do. Come on, listener. You're sitting there looking with horror at your podcast, but admit it. Come on.
So Fermi problems. Christmas Fermi problems. Yeah, I could think of a few of those.
Yeah.
Certainly Santa-related, Christmas tree-related.
I would have to say the whole kitten helium balloon thing, don't actually do it for real. Get, you know, it's 800 helium balloons tied into a kitten.
Cleeps will be onto us.
Yes, exactly, Cleeps. So you can't do that. That kitten could have someone's eye out.
I did once write a Father Christmas themed test. That went down well.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Happy Christmas. Yes. Here's a test. Father Christmas is mentioned in it.
I think I've done that too, actually. I think I did one year where I was giving them a test, and I think it was year 7 or something like that, and I felt really bad. And I said on the back, you know, there was a blank page on the back of the quiz, but I said, draw a picture of Santa. The best one will win a little Haribo pack or something. I think that was about as close as I got to festive joy that year. Oh, dear.
I'm such a curmudgeon.
Those kids are probably 40 now, and they're all scarred. They're all chartered accountants.
I'll tell you another Fermi problem at Christmas is the power draw for all the Christmas lights that are on in December. That must be phenomenal. And the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere for that.
What's the carbon footprint of Christmas?
Let's put an end to it.
You really are. on. I hope you're getting enough rest, because tonight you're going to be visited by three goats, ghosts, like Gophery goats. I'm the goat of Christmas past. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yes. I hope you're getting enough sleep, because I think tonight you're going to be visited by three ghosts. It's going to happen.
Yeah, I'm a terrible old Scrooge, aren't I? Hopeless. Anyway, now is probably a good time to give our beloved listener a present.
Yes, you've been so wonderful all year. We thought it was the least we could do than stuff your stocking full of a little treat for Christmas.
We were asked in the questionnaire to cover off some required practicals.
Ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho. And we actually managed to talk about that the other day, and we thought it would be a nice thing to share with the listener, is our take on the first required practical we came across.
Yes, and one of the most challenging, I think, which is specific heat capacity.
Yes, it has health and safety, but it is a good experiment, and we had a good old chinwag about that. So let's have a listen. Here we are again, and we are responding to the survey.
Yes, the survey.
One thing that the survey mentioned was that people would like us to cover some of the more, I'd say, more, is prosaic the right word?
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, we've done a lot on the random...
The classics.
We've done a lot on random, wonderful practicals and demos we've never heard of, but we haven't actually spent time on the classics. So we have perused the standard or the required practicals for a couple of GCSEs, and we're going to talk about some real classic experiments, just the way Robin and I would do them, and maybe that will help people who are non-specialists who are being forced to do this, you wonderful heroes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And maybe people who are really experienced at this, who tut at our, what we do, can get in touch. Contact at thephysicsteachingpodcast.com and give us their tips, and then we will talk about that on another show.
It's good. And there are some of these practicals are tricky for the kids to get hold of, and tricky for, therefore, teachers to get hold of sometimes, because the stuff being taught is somewhat abstract. It's funny, I taught GCSE for a long, long time, and it didn't have specific heat capacity in the GCSE, for example, and now it's in. And when it came in, I did have a moment of thinking, oh, that's a shame, because it's so abstract, and there's a lot of kids who probably would have come away with a positive image of physics. That's just going to make that a little bit more challenging, because it's so abstract, it's so difficult, it's so hard to get hold of. So there are some in there that you think, oh, that's right on the edge of what I'd say is an engaging physics practical. Is that fair?
Yeah, and it's funny you should mention specific heat capacity, because in my exhaustive research for this, when I Googled required practicals and looked at the first practical I found, that is specific heat capacity. And I think that, you know, we've mentioned cognitive science that I've learned about since we started the podcast, and that's one right there that is very challenging, because, well, to start with, you've got to understand that you've got to be able to make a circuit with PD and current. You've got to be able to measure that. You've got to be able to get that right. You've got to then multiply them to get the power. And that's before you even get near specific heat capacity.
Absolutely.
So that's a good one to talk about.
Mm. And I've got a couple of things, I suppose, that I cheat with here. And because this is one of the things why I'm a little saddened that it's a required practical, because you do need the block of metal with the ammeter and the voltmeter and the stopwatch and the insulation and the oil and all these sorts of things. And that's fine, but doing it with the kettle is far more intuitive. And the whole power thing, you just read the power off the bottom of the kettle and say, okay, so it's delivering 1850 watts. That's 1850 joules every second. So times how many seconds you've got the kettle on for, and measure the temperature at the beginning and end. You know, it's a really simple way of doing it. So I don't know. That's my tip. But of course, you can't go into the GCSE exam and describe a kettle. So it's a way of breaking the ice, maybe, and giving kids an introductory practical and saying you can measure the specific heat capacity of water doing this. But then when you actually get round to the block of metal, explain, well, this is slightly more challenging, and we have to go back to our Ohm's law and electricity and think about P equals IV and these sorts of things. So
I wonder. I really like the kettle experiment, and I used it with my A-level this year. And I wonder if you could set that up as homework and just do an introduction to specific capacity, set that as a homework, give them clear instructions how to do it, and then they'll have done some thinking at home, hopefully. Yeah. I do love the home practical homework. and then you can launch into the metal block, because the metal block's the one they're going to be asked about in the exams, because that's the way it works now, isn't it? They expect them to have done it, and they will ask questions about it.
Yeah, more's the pity, because it is, sadly, you know, should it be that particular experimental setup, which is not the only way to measure specific capacity? So, well, we could go into that debate, but that's a bit of a blind alley. The sirens that you hear approaching in the distance, that's Cleeps on their way. So before we do that, when you're setting this for homework, do make sure you do something reasonable. So when they fill their kettle with cold water and they turn it on, I think probably about 15 to 20 seconds is enough to get a measurable change in temperature. For goodness sake, don't suggest that they stick their hand with a thermometer into a kettle of boiling water.
Well, personally, I'd say assume the temperature of the water coming out the tap's 20 and assume when it boils.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's 100. You don't need to measure the temperature.
Okay.
And I think that it's probably safe to boil a kettle at home.
Yeah.
So I would use that 80 degree rise. Just measure carefully the volume of water in the kettle.
Yeah.
And inevitably there'll be the kids like I had who has a 100 degree tap, and then just get to talk to their friends about the results they got.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that's the thing. So basically, just it's worth being a little bit safe. You know, there's no reason ever to stick your hand into a kettle that's boiled. So when it comes to measuring the temperature, make assumptions or be safe. But I would have to do that. Hopefully, that's Cleeps satisfied.
A good question on this is the experiment's about heating a block with a heater.
Yes,
not is. About making the circuit. And I've worked at one school, and I've worked at a few, where they didn't use PD and current. They had a power meter.
Yeah, yeah.
So they just plugged the heater into the power meter, and that read the power. So I imagine in the exam they won't... Well, of course, they'll expect them to know about PD and current, won't they, because of the electricity part.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's why they love it as a practical, I think, is because it's synoptic. Yes, absolutely. You can get joule meters, I think, that actually count the joules that are delivered as they go through.
So. The joule meters, though, I think every school in 1970 or something was sent a joule meter and had a ribbon cable. And I know a lot of teachers listening to this were going, yeah, we've still got that. Had a little ribbon on, which doesn't plug into anything now because that technology is so old. But it does flash a light every 1,000 joules.
Ah.
And you can get the whole class sitting and watching that red light and counting 1,000, 2,000, 3,000.
It sounds like a Doctor Who plot. But anyway, that's when they get to 8,000, they're all hypnotised and taken over by aliens.
So, back to the practical.
Yes, let's zero back in.
So I wouldn't start it unless I had some confidence they knew how to make the circuit. Mm-hmm. And I'd do what has been suggested on the podcast before. I'd have a working circuit at the front. And if their circuit doesn't work, they can swap out the bit they think is not working. And I want to be confident that they could get the power by multiplying current by PD. I might even do that. I know we're under time pressure, but that I might do that as a revision of electricity for one lesson. Just can we measure the power of this heater?
Mm.
So that's where I'd start. I wouldn't want to do this unless they understood the power and it's the energy pouring into the block.
Mm.
Once they understand that, I think then it's conceptually easier.
Yeah, don't you mean that the thermal store of the block is being filled by the energy transfer that is electrical from the chemical store at the power station? I think that's probably where we were going with that, wasn't it? I don't know. Anyway, so yeah, well...
Can't see my face.
I think they can imagine it.
Yeah.
Everybody's got the energy face. Everybody knows what the energy face looks like. We all have that. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, did I not say that it's the pouring the energy into the thermal store of the block? I'm sure that's my exact words.
I think that's exactly what you said, yes. Mm. Now you come to mention it. Mm. Put that flashing light away now. So, yes, the other thing I was, if you just put yourself into the cold and dark soul that is the examiner here, sorry examiners, I'm only joking, if you were going to ask questions about this practical, what sort of things would you be examining, what sort of things would you be looking at, what sort of things should we emphasise here?
I definitely think it's the sort of practical they might be asked to do a plan for. Mm-hmm. So what measurements do you need to take?
Yes.
Well, once you've understood the concept of the energy store in the block increasing, the thermal energy store increasing, then it's what effect does that have? And the effect it has is changing the temperature. So you'd want to know the starting temperature,
mm-hmm.
the ending temperature.
Yep.
And you'd want to know the time that mm-hmm. took. Ideally, I would plot a graph for this. I would do it as a time temperature graph.
Mm-hmm.
But that is, again, conceptually demanding because you can get the specific capacity from that gradient.
Mm.
You can do it just with the raw numbers, get the time and temperature and work out the energy that has been stored in the block.
Mm-hmm.
and then use that to get the specific capacity.
Yeah.
But I would draw a graph.
Okay, so you can do that, of course. I think the exam questions probably wouldn't insist on that because they would know that some people hadn't. But on the other hand, I do think there's some difficulty and confusion about what the independent variable is in this case, because obviously you have to calculate the energy that is being transferred into the block every second, and you have to calculate the total energy transferred into the block over time. So I that's what I would describe as the independent variable, but I know there'll be a lot of people who disagree and say, oh no, it's this, it's that, it's the other. So that's one that the exam board might well decide to zero in on. I think I'd still describe the independent variable as the energy.
Yeah, and that's this example I'm looking at here, they have the work done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The store increase on the x-axis and the temperature on the y-axis, and then the 1 over the gradient is the specific heat capacity.
Mm.
Any health and safety you'd be concerned about with this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a good one to ask about risk assessment for, because it does get hot.
It does get hot quite quickly, especially if you've got aluminium or copper.
Yeah,
what temperature would you tell them to stop at?
I think I'd probably look at 60 degrees. I think it'd
be
absolute outside. I'd probably tell them to stop earlier than that. If you're going from 20, a decent range is up to 50, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
So then if some miss that and go to 60, you're okay. It gives you a buffer, but I wouldn't go further than that.
Yeah, I'd couch it in hot water from the tap. You wouldn't put your fingers under the hot tap in most circumstances, and that's usually below 60 degrees. And at the max it would be 60 degrees, and you've also always got the overrun when they turn off the heater, the block will continue getting hotter. So I say if it's not off at 55, then I'm concerned, and I would expect them to turn it off at 50.
Yeah absolutely. So the heat of the block is the main thing. There will be others. The block is heavy, and you are using oil, so therefore your hands may be slippery as you handle it.
Okay, so we haven't mentioned the oil. Why go on about the oil?
Yes, the oil. So if you can envisage the metal block that you've used, if you've done the experiment, apologies for going over a grab, but the metal block that you tend to use is a milled piece of aluminium or steel. It's a cylinder with two holes drilled in the top, one smaller, one larger. The larger one is to take the heater and the smaller one is to take the thermometer. Typically the good advice is that you put a little bit of 3-in-1 oil into each of those holes so that good thermal contact is made between the heater and the thermometer and the metal, so that you've got a good solid heat transfer. You're not losing any energy. You're not transferring any energy to the thermal store of the surroundings, which is inefficient. So that's the reason for that. But of course, that does mean there's 3-in-1 oil knocking around. Kids typically fill the whole of the reservoir up with 3-in-1 and then stick the peter in, and so you've got oil everywhere. And again, if you're picking up large 1-kilogram blocks of metal with oily hands, then there's the risk of those being dropped. So that's the idea. Make sure you wipe your hands with paper towel before you pick up the blocks, or even pick up the blocks with paper towel so that you don't drop them, and be careful, pick them up two-handed. That would be another risk. So it's a good risk assessment practical.
I tend to get very distracted on the oil one, because I think of the conundrum. How much water do you need to float the Titanic?
How much water?
In integer litres.
To float the Titanic?
Yeah.
I don't know.
One. You press the Titanic into a huge piece of plasticine until you've got a Titanic-sized hole, and then you pour 1 litre into it, and you put the Titanic in, and you get a 1-molecule thick layer of water, and it's floating.
Okay.
Because it would have displaced its entire weight of water, and it's left 1 litre, so you only need 1 litre to float the Titanic. So they only need one drop of oil, because it's such a close fit, don't they?
I'd have to think about that, but
I can see that's slightly broken you, but that is true.
Has.
And this goes back to floating the lights in lighthouses. Mm-hmm. They used to float them on mercury so they turn smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
You think, oh God, that's dangerous, a lot of mercury. No, they'd have maybe a cup of mercury, maybe 500 grams of mercury in this huge hole. They'd pour it in, and then they'd put this very tight-fitting circle in the hole. And obviously mercury is very, very, very dense. So you've displaced hundreds of kilos of mercury, but you don't need that. All that would gush out onto the floor, wouldn't it? If you filled your mercury to the brim and put your lighthouse light in it, all the mercury would gush out onto the floor. So you don't bother to take the stuff that gushes out on the floor up your lighthouse. Think about it. It's completely true. Yeah, so I do get a bit distracted.
Okay.
And the kids have the look that's on your face exactly as it is now across the whole class. So I try and avoid that, but it is really interesting, that floating conundrum.
I'll go and have a think about that. But yeah, so risk assessment, it's a decent practical for risk assessment, because there are, you know, some of the practicals, when you're trying to find three potential hazards with a practical, you're somewhat reaching.
Yes.
with this one, I think there genuinely are some hazards there, like the heat and the fact that you are using oil and the fact that you have a very heavy block of metal, which really could do damage if it dropped on someone's foot. So those are all good things to consider. Anomalies and uncertainties, I suppose, they could throw some data at you and ask. And you're absolutely right, because the reason that they're going to like it, because it's a synoptic question, because you can calculate power from the current and the voltage that you are putting into the circuit. So therefore, that's probably something they might ask you to do, or call on you to do as a follow-up. Efficiency?
I'll tell you another thing they could ask is, why is the block of aluminium you're using, that's a kilogram, the different size to the block of steel that you're using, that's a kilogram? And that's another synoptic question going back into density.
Yep, absolutely. They could ask that. They could ask for efficiency, I think. They could probably ask for an efficiency calculation in a question about this. So all in all, there's plenty of questions. So this would be a popular... When an examiner's sitting there thinking, what can I torture the kids? I mean, what can I ask the kids about? They think about things and areas where... Sorry, examiners, I know, I'm sorry. But they're thinking about areas where there's a lot of physics happening. And there is a lot of physics happening here, which was what makes it a challenging practical. Because typically on your scheme of work, it'll say, one lesson, do specific capacity, get on.
It's not a one lesson practical. Yeah, it, this one I would give some time to. I'd have a run into it and do it properly, because it does touch on so much of physics.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also the other thing I'd say is, I think this one crops up quite a lot in year 11, doesn't it? I think it's one that's done towards the ends of courses a lot.
So this is 16-year-old.
Well, this is it. And also, but usually they're tight on time. So the idea of, you should take three lessons to do that, that might not be an option. So if you do have to do it as a demo, and these things do happen, I know, that's okay. But do make sure that you set some of those kinds of questions, perhaps as homework, perhaps as follow-up. On things like, you know, what's the efficiency of the process? You know, look at this list of data. What's the anomalous results? Why do we do this? Why do we do that? Why is the steel smaller than the aluminium? Use it as a real opportunity to do some revision across all the topics. This whole thing of the cognitive science, you know, recall and all these sorts of things, this is a good opportunity to recall a lot of the physics that they've done in previous years and wrap it up into one package.
So I am sure the dear listener will be tutting and saying, well, I do it differently. Mm. We'd love to hear from you.
Absolutely.
Contact at thephysicsteachingpodcast.com. I think we said that at the start. Right?
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah, there's loads of... what we'll try and do is do some show notes that basically have some basic instructions on these, some low state. And as you said, the cognitive overload on this is huge. So we'll try and put some instructions that have clear diagrams that show and try and do it via diagrams. That's the thing. If I tend to find when I have a practical that's cognitive overload in terms of the instruction setup, doing it via pictures really helps. Thanks to, I think it's at Ollie Cav on Twitter, who's the guy who's done a whole book on dual coding, and this was one of his tips. If you've got something really complicated, the way to lay it out is with pictures and doing that. So we'll try and find something that we can do with that. And good luck with it. And if you've got any tips and anything that's worked really well with your kids, do let us know.
I actually really enjoyed talking about that. It's just nice just talking through a really fundamental practical and thinking about it and getting your ideas about it.
Yeah, it is a classic, isn't it? And it's a classic for a good reason, because it is talking about a very, very strange phenomenon in physics, which tends to be slightly counterintuitive and can cause some difficulty to get. Although everybody is familiar with the idea that when you walk on a beach, the sand is hot and the water's cold. So things heat up at different rates. You know.
Goes back to my saucepan earlier. I hope that was useful, listener, and I'm sure you'll let us know on Twitter at PhysicsTP or contact at thephysicsteachingpodcast.com. And I think I enjoyed doing that, so I think we'll do more in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. More required practice come. And if there's one particularly that you'd like to hear about, or indeed, as always, if you have any tips, anything that you do that make these core practicals really live, or make them that little bit more accessible, or just anything to do with the required practicals in terms of tips and tricks, do get in touch. At PhysicsTP on Twitter.
At Physics_teaching_podcast on Instagram.
Or indeed, you can email us at contact@thephysicsteachingpodcast.com.
And on the website, the.physicsteachingpodcast.com. has a contact form on every page. And if you actually want to come on and talk about a core practical, do get in touch. We love having different physics teachers on.
Absolutely. Well, I think that should just about wrap it up probably for this episode and for 2019, I think, because this will be our last one.
Yeah, I think so. If we have a long Christmas break, because I think I need, goodness me, teaching Year 7 has been hard work. Oh, I'd forgotten, goodness.
Yeah.
So yes, we're going to have a long Christmas break this year. Thank you very much, listener. And we will speak to you in January. Well, thanks, Robin. It's been a pleasure.
As always, Thomas, have a great Christmas.
You too.